A wee mention for Eva, Aisling and Sinead and their teacher Mairead from PCC Fallcarra. They're down at Dhunkatúra, the world, the finals today. Is it the world finals? From Sinead's family. More than happy to do that for you. Right, okay. Just actually, we had a question yesterday and it read as follows. Can you check if this is true? Does anyone know when you now attend Now Doc, they no longer put you in stitches? You have to attend ED because the service was being sued for scar issues. The second part of that, anyway, we put it to Now Doc. When a member of the public rings a Now Doc service, their call is logged and a triage nurse based in the Letterkenny call centre speaks to the caller. The triage nurse discusses the patient's symptoms and carries out a comprehensive nurse assessment. In the case of a caller with a laceration, the nurse considers history, patient's age, severity of bleeding, location of the laceration, size and depth. The Now Doc triage nurse determines the most appropriate level of care, which may be one of the following, depending on the clinical assessment: 999, ambulance, emergency department, consultation with Now Doc, duty GP, self-care advice. Where an appointment is made to attend Now Doc GP services, the doctor examines the patients and determines his, her treatment plan. Wound treatments, i.e. cleansing, suturing, gluing and steer strip applications are carried out by the doctors in Now Doc as appropriate on a case-by-case basis. So they say they are doing gluing and steri-strip. That doesn't reference stitching. I presume stitching is something else. Okay. Right, let's stay with health. Anna, good morning to you.
Hello.
Anna, you're as frustrated as a lot of people, aren't you, as it relates to the ongoing issues in the health service here?
I am, yes.
Who do you blame? What's your view? You were at the ED earlier this year. Can you draw on your own experience?
Yeah, I landed in the ED. I was sent out. My GP sent me out. And say it was chaotic, you know, would be putting it mildly. There were people sitting on the floor. There were people standing in the walls. There doesn't seem to be as much seating in the ED as there used to be. And there were people, it was just chaotic. Just people were waiting. People weren't being seen. Then they'd see two or three. Then there'd be lulls for maybe a couple of hours where people weren't being seen. And this was on like all night. This was went on all night. And, you know, there weren't enough seats for people. People were standing with the elderly patients, you know, standing behind their wheelchairs. And they were standing for maybe 3 or 4 hours. And then other people would say to them, you know, like, they motioned them over to where there was a spare seat, you know, later on at night. And it was just terrible. It's not acceptable.
You were waiting for 28, nearly 29 hours for a bed. What happened over the period of those? I mean, that's a day in a bit, by the way, just for people who may not be aware. But what happened over that 29 hours? Because you were obviously sick enough to be sent there in the first instance. Were you treated at all, or what was the story?
Well, I went out in the afternoon, mid-afternoon, and what I have times of the essence, and because I've had it before, I've been admitted before 2 years ago, year previous. Yeah. So I know times of the essence. So I went out, went to checked in, and had a queue for ages to check in, and checked in eventually, got a seat, and waited a bit longer this time for the triage nurse. Seen the triage nurse, got all that done, back out again. I was lucky to get a seat again, and I was sitting there then, there was nothing happening. Like 1 a.m. in the morning, I was talking to a lady, and she said, why don't you go and find out where you are on the list? So I went in the back, asked where I was on the list, and she told me I was number 30-something. And I thought, oh, well, that's, you know, tomorrow at this rate. Mm. And my symptoms were getting worse and worse and worse.
And you know from your medical history that intravenous antibiotics need to be applied to you as soon as possible. That's your...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I said, well, can I talk to somebody? And I said to them, I was really annoyed at the stage and I was getting fed up. I was worried. I was worried more than anything. And I said to them, I said, look, I know from past history that I need to be on antibiotics IV, and I said I'd be as well to be hooked up to the IV while I'm sitting here anyway. So they said, right, we'll go and talk to the doctor. So 2 hours later, 3 a.m. that morning, the next morning, they came back and they called me in and they put in a cannula and they did hook me up to the IV. So then I was sitting out the back, but while I was sitting out the back, like, I was there obviously 9 o'clock the next morning, and the people that were there from evening previous, they were still all there. Like, nobody was moving. I don't know what the issue is. Is it management? Is it? And my opinion is that the ED isn't big enough. Mm-hmm. There isn't enough room. The hallways were thrown with people.
But also, so Anna, people, the issue is as well. You know, whilst you went up, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but going by the statement, you've been initially assessed, and you were told then at one point that you were 30th in line. But if five people walk in who they determine to be less well off than you, they instantly go ahead of you. Because the proposal is or the situation is that care is given based on need. So even though you're there, you need your IV antibiotics, all the while you're sitting there, people could be coming in ahead of you. Maybe that's the way to do it. I don't know. But, I mean, even knowing you're 30th is not necessarily a strong indication of when you might be seen.
No, that's true. I understand, of course, like needs must. I understand people who are, you know, for want of a better word, you know, more sick than what I am. Of course, they need to get seen sooner. But I think there needs to be more doctors. There need to be more cubicles. There aren't half enough cubicles in the ED. Not half enough. And, like, people run the queue because they were really sick. I had to go down at that time when I was speaking to the nurse to find out, you know, where I was in the list. There aren't half enough cubicles, and every corridor had people in chairs, like out the back of the ED, people in chairs and on wheelchairs and hooked up to IV. You know, just like it was like the wall was just lined of people hooked up to IVs.
And yours is a familiar story in that when you were admitted and you were there for over a week, you have no fault for the treatment of care, but you have questions that I think a lot of people have questions for, and you believe answers should be given. What is the story in the ED? What's the holdup? Is it beds? Is it nurses? Is it doctors? Is it consultants? What's going on here? Now, we've invited the general manager, Sean Murphy, onto the show. It's a familiar situation, and it's probably going to be about home care packages, you know, families being able to receive those that don't need acute hospital care anymore, places in hospitals. That's all going to be contributing to it. But whatever it is, Anna, we need to get to the bottom of it clearly.
Yes. Here's an example as well of the chaos in the ED. Like, I know from past history that my limb has to be elevated. And I asked for a stool for my leg to be elevated, and I was actually told that she went away and she came back and she actually told me, she said, I was told this on two or three occasions, that there's only one stool in the ED and it was in use. Like a stool, like how much does a stool cost? Like how much does a stool cost? You know, I'd nearly buy it for them myself, you know. So then I was talking to another, she wasn't a nurse, but she must have been admin. I don't know who she was, but I told her and she went away actually and she got me a little wheelie stool. And she says, here, put your leg up on that and put the blanket. I had a blanket. She's put the blanket over it. Like, that's terrible.
All right. Anna, listen, I hope your health is good at the moment. Thank you so much for joining us and helping us understand. Sue's with us as well. Hiya, Sue.
Good morning, Greg.
How are you getting on? You found yourself in the ED on Friday. What was the situation with you and what was your experience?
Yeah, well, I sprained my ankle on Thursday evening when I was out walking. And I knew I would have to go to A&E, so I left it to Friday. And I went down on Friday, and I went in at about 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I was dreading going in case I would have to wait while long, but thankfully I didn't have to wait too long. I was in about 2 hours and a half, and I was glad to get out again.
Brilliant.
And it wasn't too bad. Like, there were a lot of staff on now. They were very good, seeing me very quick. So
when you then it emerged yesterday and into this morning that the hospital is so overcrowded, does it make you wonder, well, what changed between Friday and what changed between Friday and Monday that things changed so dramatically soon?
I don't know. I was just lucky that day. Like, good, sometimes people can be lucky and other people can't be lucky. So I just was my lucky day, I guess.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's nice when it goes well for people.
Yeah,
too.
I just feel sorry for them all. People that have been waiting for a really long time, for ages, like. I wouldn't like to be waiting that long, but I was lucky. Like, I was only on 2 hours and a half.
Good stuff. No break or anything? Just walk it off? Is that the... Hopefully you're okay?
Yeah, well, I'm on a boot. They put me on a boot and I'm on crutches as well.
Right.
And they said I might have to wear the boot maybe for 4 weeks. I have to look after myself, like walk around, keep the blood circulating. Mm. You know, don't be sitting too long. That's what they told me because my doctor phoned me yesterday and... just asking how it was, so I have to look after myself, Greg. There'll be no long walks now for a while.
Well, in fairness, though, you seem to be getting the best of care, and hopefully you've someone there to bring you tea.
Yeah, people have been asking. Like, if I want anything, they can bring things in to me, and maybe take me over the town, drive me over the town.
Good stuff. Well, look after
because
yourselves.
Because you can't really walk too far. No, you can't.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah, you have to walk a bit, but not too far. Sue, hopefully it's not 4 weeks. Hopefully your next checkup you have it off and you're back out and at it again. Thanks, Sue. Take care of yourself there. Right, okay. We've also been talking about parking at Letterkenny University Hospital. Michelle's with me. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
Hi, Michelle. It's Greg here. You're live on Highland.
Hi.
We're talking about parking.
Hi, Greg.
Great to speak to you, Michelle. We're talking about parking at Letterkenny University Hospital as well and people paying for 24 hours and this, that and that. What was your experience?
So I was 8 months pregnant and just went in for a check over an A&E, and it just was it was 4 hours within midnight, so it was like 9 p.m. So I was like, oh, I'll pay for 24 hours. If I happen to get kept, hoping not to get kept, I'll have 24 hours paid and that'll be fine. But you can only pay max €3 at that time of night because it renews at midnight. And then I did get kept, so I went down then after midnight to then pay for a 24-hour parking ticket of €6 because it would allow me on the machine at that point at the A&E car park. And then I was covered for the next day then. But that meant me leaving the ward at 12:30 at night to go down to make sure I'd paid up, to make sure it was covered.
Just imagine the imagery.
Because I could never get the online to work.
You 8 months pregnant, heading back out at midnight to get a parking ticket for your car. The last thing you want needed to be doing, I'm sure. So the logical thing here is that the 24 hours runs from whenever you purchase the ticket.
Yes, and I didn't realise that wouldn't happen. Mm. And the system would only let me pay €3. So then I was like, right, I don't know why that's happening. And I asked the staff, they're like, oh, it renews at midnight. So then I understood why it would only let me pay the €3 for 4 hours of parking. Although I only maybe got 2 or 3 hours off that parking ticket. Mm-hmm. And then I had to renew it. Now, I know I've spoken to other people in general, and like nurses have given them the information, ring the parking number and you'll be fine. But the nurse I spoke with, and I was well enough to go down now, but the nurse I spoke with just said, it renews at midnight. You need to, yeah. I was like, I'm going to pay for my parking now. They're like, yeah, okay, we'll see you in a few minutes again then.
Right.
So they just didn't think to give me the information at that point in time, you know, and things either.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise because I hadn't stayed in the hospital a long time. So I didn't realise that you need to ring the parking people to get assistance.
I know. Now, how would you know that off the top of your head? Especially if you've other things
on
your mind.
No, that's it.
Okay. Michelle, listen, thanks. How's everything since?
Yeah, baby is doing great. We're baby massage class this morning. We're full here, so
go on.
Oh well,
baby massage. Does the baby? Yeah. I would want the baby massaging me. And can I ask Michelle what name did you give your baby?
Baby Tony, little girl, baby Tony.
Tony, lovely. T O N I or T O? Yeah.
Yeah,
T-O-N-I, lovely name. Okay, that's beautiful to hear. I'm so delighted for you that you've got your lovely baby with you. And the massage classes actually sounds wonderful. Thanks so much indeed. Stay there. Thank you. Sorry, don't stay there. You can go now. Thank you very much, Michelle. But stay there, Hugh, if you don't mind, because I do have to take a break. And there's a couple of other callers coming in on this. So I'll be back in about 2 minutes. Hugh, sorry for holding you. Thanks so much for your patience.
No problem.
Good morning to you. So what was your experience? You were in with your better half, I think, recently, weren't you?
Yeah, Craig, Sunday, my wife became ill with dizzy spells in her side of her face, swole. So we contacted Now Doctor and we got an appointment with Now Doc at 4:30. So went through into Now Doc. She was in with the doctor about 40 minutes and he came out and he handed me the letter and he said, could you take her straight to Casley? He said, I've done a hand test on her and I'm not happy, he said, because her central signs is not looking too good. Mm. And I said, fair enough. So I assisted her out of the car because she could hardly walk with the dizzy spell she was taking. So we went to Casley at 5:30. We got seen by the triangle nurse quite quickly inside 15 minutes at 6:15. So we went to I was out to the waiting room. We sat in the waiting room then to 7:30, 8:15. So I got inside and I asked at the desk, I said, sorry, can you indicate where my wife is in terms of the list? She's second to be seen. And I said, I'm quite concerned because she's a history of TIs, which is many strokes. She had a major stroke 10 years ago. And the last stroke was 4 years ago. So I was quite worried, Craig, that she was having a stroke, you know, or signs of a stroke. So I indicated that to them and they said, no, the doctor will be with you shortly. Mm. So she was quite dizzy sitting out and I helped her and supported her the best I could. So I said, it's not going to be much longer. 8:30, 9:00. I went in at 9:10. And I said, sorry, I said, I'm really thinking, can you tell me where my wife is? She was two in the list at 7:30. There's five in front of her.
Wow.
And I said, sorry, how did that happen? I said, look, I'm really concerned. My wife could be, you know, having a stroke here. The doctor indicated that it's in the letter that she needs to be treated with urgency. We'll get to her very shortly. 10 o'clock came, Craig. There was two people in the A&E at that stage.
Mm.
Sitting out in the waiting room alongside ourselves. I went back in at 10:30. They said, we'll see you shortly. 12 o'clock, 10 to 12 came, and I basically nearly had enough of it. I went in, and there was 8 or 9 of them standing around the desk, and I said, what's going on here? And they said, well, what's wrong? And I said, my wife, you know, name. And I said, look, the severity of it, I said, if you talk about fast face, arm, speech and time, if my wife was having a bleed in the brain, her face is all swollen, she's having dizzy spells, the doctor has indicated to you that this is a very urgent matter. I said, she's been sitting in the waiting room for over 6 hours. 6 hours, Craig, mm-hmm. without getting assessed, or getting her blood pressure done, or without even getting checked. And that was me in and out quite often, asking them for an update, what was happening. They were quite quiet at that time, Craig. They weren't busy. Now they had a few people in the beds and the A&E and inside the vicinity. But my wife then, when I went back in at 12:15, 12:20, and I said, give me the letter because I'm going to Altigavin. I'm going to take my wife to Altigavin. And they said, oh no, we'll get the doctor now. But she's basically sat, Craig, from 5:45 with a suspected TEA from NOWDOC to 12:30 before she's seen the doctor. So, like, if people think that's appropriate or the HSE thinks that's appropriate, we talk about, you know, the signs and symptoms of strokes, you know, and we talk about how important it is to catch a stroke as quickly as possible because of the severity of it. The more it lasts, the more it impacts your body.
Okay.
So HSE thinks it's acceptable to set somebody who's went through the process from NOWDOC to get a letter who is suspected TEA to sit for 6 hours in the waiting room without getting her blood pressure done, without anybody looking at coming to check, without anybody indicating that with anything happening, you know, how do we find that acceptable?
Okay, and at what stage was she admitted then, Hugh? Was that in the early hours, or did you?
She was seen at 12:30, Craig. She was seen at 12:30 by the doctor who indicated a CT scan then. So we went down for the CT scan at about 1:15 or 1:30. Then it takes an hour and a half because an independent company looks at the CT scans. So it was about 4:00 before the results come back.
Mm, okay, all right.
And then the doctor recommended that she get an X-ray and an ECG done. And before we met the medical team, Craig, it was 5:30, 5:45.
In the morning, the following morning.
In the morning.
Right.
So. Like, I just so disappointed in the way the hospital's been run at the minute. And, you know, honestly, it doesn't take a scientist to work it out. It doesn't take a genius to work it out what's wrong up there. You know, and it's just the system is so flawed at the minute. It is unbelievable. Okay. And people's lives at risk. It's not about, you know, saying, look, we have got a bad system. The system's not working. People are seriously at risk, especially people like my wife. Or people have severity of chest pain, or taking heart attacks, or has, you know, God help the people, Craig, that can't speak English, that goes into casualty. That's all I can say.
Right.
If you can't indicate and talk up for yourself, and staff that I know up there have told me on Sunday night, Kiwi, you're going to have to be authoritative. You're not authoritative, you're not going to get anywhere. And this is staff in the hospital.
All right,
that knows me.
Listen, I hope your wife is feeling better now, Hugh. Thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks, Craig. Thank you.
Right, take care of yourself. Right, let me see. Is Rachel there? Rachel, are you there?
Hello, Greg. How's it going?
Rachel, I'm so sorry to hold you there. Right, okay, what's your situation?
Where do I start? I have a 4-year-old who swallowed 20 cents on the 30th of December. Mm. And we obviously... it wasn't choking him. He was drinking that fine. So we waited a few weeks and took him then to casualty to see what did it pass. Now, we had been screening, but knew it didn't come out. So had the first x-ray and the 20 cents still inside him. sent home, and then we had to take him back up then because he was experiencing a bit of pain. So we had a second x-ray. The coin was still in the same position. We then were told, go home, Crumlin will contact you. So that evening we went home and we got a phone call from the doctor saying that Crumlin don't want to see you. The coin stays. So I thought that was kind of bad in itself. So that was okay. I rang Crumlin next day, and the advice I got from Crumlin was, the doctor wasn't told to say that. He was told to say, review in a month, high fibre diet. That was grand. So we've done that. The month was up, took him to the GP. The GP got an x-ray. So that was the third x-ray again last week, or the week before last. The coin's still in the same position.
Well, it's not dislodging at all. It hasn't moved. It's not stuck in the same place.
Still in the same position, yeah. The three x-rays still in the same position. So the GP had referred him then to Crumlin. So I was told that it was a triage system down there, and basically they would review and get back with an appointment. As of yesterday or Monday morning, I have rang that he still, that the, his referral still hasn't even been looked at in Crumlin at the minute, you know, and it's just, it's ridiculous now. The coin's been in him now 9 weeks and he is getting sick, and it probably isn't the coin causing it, but in the back of my head, I'm thinking, right, you know.
Well, everything's going to be about the coin, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. You don't know.
Yeah.
Have you been told of any potential dangers of the coin remaining where it is, you know, like in terms, I don't know how it might interact with stomach acid or whatever. I don't know the ins and outs of it, Rachel, but has there been any, have you been given any advice as to if there's any imminent danger to him? Not that that would explain the delay, don't get me wrong, but
like,
just
as I say, we haven't kind of had any advice. As I say, right. I was told over the phone by Crumlin, you know, give him a high fibre diet, they'll review it in a month. But as I say, that's we're still waiting on Crumlin, because, as I say, there's nothing up this area for the kids to go to. Everything's down the country,
course,
you know.
Yeah.
So we're sitting waiting. They did say, no, take him to A&E, but I could take him down there. But the likelihood is we'll drive 4 hours down, sit and wait 8 hours down there and be told then to go home, and they'll give another appointment for a test. And, you know, I have other kids too at home. I can't just head on to Dublin and then head back to, do you know what I mean? They have three x-rays. All they have to do is say, right, kind of such a date, and we'll get this thing removed.
But
you know what
it
I mean?
Should be the case. Listen, it's bad enough, right, that a lot of these services are at the other end of the country, but the local health service should be a front door to the likes of Beaumont. You know what I mean? You shouldn't have to present there. If your son needs an intervention in Beaumont, the front door should be the GP stroke ED or hospital. Do you know what I mean? You shouldn't have to be worrying
like
how you engage with the hospital.
Go
ahead, Rachel.
Sorry, my GP has said, like, you know, go back to Letterkenny, but like, I know for a fact we'll go back to Letterkenny and we'll say, right, it's Crumlin that deals with this. It's, do you know what I mean?
Yes,
you know, so
yes.
We're stuck, you know. I just feel like we're just being pinballed from one to another, to another, to another, you know. And my fear is too, because the coin's been in that long too, does the body start to form over it? You know, is there going to be further complications down the road? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's frustrating me now really badly at this stage, you know.
I can imagine it is. This might be one that we can move on. We'll make inquiries just to see if it rattles any cages, Rachel, okay? Obviously, there's big stuff that, you know what I mean? It's an ongoing sort of a thing, but maybe an individual case like this, we can get some movement on it, no pun intended. So leave it with us.
And he has been potty trained, but because we've had to screen his toilets, he's now had a nappy and he's starting school in September. We're back with him back to nappies. He will have to be re-potty trained again. You know, it's not fair in him either.
No, and you don't want him,
you know,
getting a notion about going to the toilet either, because that can be really hard to break. You know, if they... Some kids start holding in their poos and stuff when there's other stuff associated with it.
Every time you change into, he turns around and says, "Any money yet? Any money yet?" That's what the focus is, you know.
Okay.
Every time you change him, "Any money yet? Any money yet?" You know.
It's like a wee cash register. God bless him.
That's it. Because I read a joke on Facebook there last week. What about the child that swallowed the coins? No change yet, you know. So.
Oh. Right. Anyway, the wee angel. Come here. Of course, you have to. You go mad if you couldn't see some. It could be one of those ones that his best man brings out on his wedding day. Who's to say? But what we'll do is we'll see if we can move things along with the HSC. As you know, we should get equal access to treatment here in Donegal, even if it's in Beaumont, as someone in Dublin. And passing our best wishes, and hopefully this is all a distant memory in the not too distant future. Rachel, God bless you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much,
great,
Greg.
Great
Thank
to chat
you.
To
Bye-bye.
You. Okay, bye-bye. A caller says, I blame the GPs, as far too many people are sent to ED. Whether it's glue or stitches, GPs are more than qualified to do it. the thing with the GPs is that if you, and this is not playing blaming or anything like that there, but we've had a dramatic increase in the population in this county in the last short period of time, a dramatic increase. And there's no additional resources. There's no additional resources there. There was talk of a fund to help. Remember Leo Varadkar talked of 20 million. I don't know if that went anywhere. But my point being is that GPs are wedged. They are genuinely wedged. And maybe they need more support in what they're doing. But you can't overstretch services and then have an additional 10 or 20,000 people and expect things to improve. You know, we have to use a little bit of logic here. They need, we need more services, and GPs are wedged. They're packed out. They can't see as many people. And it's not like, you know, it's not like a restaurant that gets busy and you hire five more staff and open up three or more tables. It's much more complex than that. Maybe we can get a word from the GP Representative Association in this county. We've got some fantastic GPs that listen to us as well. I'd be interesting to sort of... A lot of people are blaming GPs, and maybe they're correct in blaming GPs. I'm not here defending GPs, but it's important, I suppose, that we get to the root cause of this problem, and if we have an ire, that it's directed in the right direction. But stay right where you are. We have a break and loads more to squeeze in into this last half hour. So, all this week, in association with the Donegal Sports Partnership, as part of Women in Sport Week 25, we're looking at the role of women in sport. And this morning, we're joined by Sinead McHugh, who is a ref. Good morning to you, Sinead.
Hiya, Greg. Morning.
My first question is, why would anyone become a ref? Let's forget about gender and weeks and everything. I mean, it's a poison chalice.
Good question.
Or maybe we only hear the one side of it.
Yeah. No, to be fair, all I've had really is positive. There's very few negative interactions, I'd say, from my point of view. I suppose, yeah, I was playing, I was coaching, and then refereeing. There was a shortage. Like, I suppose any county, there's a shortage of referees. And I found as well, it's probably the next best thing to playing, because you're still in the middle of the field. You're still togged out. You're still, you know, running the length of the field. So you're still very much involved in the play, I would say. So good from that perspective.
What kind of fitness do you need to ref in terms of compared to when you were at your peak playing? You probably don't need to be at that level, but you have to cover a lot of ground.
Yeah, it's a different type of fitness, I suppose. Playing wise, yeah, your fitness is good, but you can take a break. You know, if you've done a few runs, you can say, right, that's me done for a couple of minutes. I'll take a breather and let the other 14 players around you. Whereas a referee, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You have to go. You have to keep going. That's it. So.
And often the best refereeing is refereeing you don't notice, isn't it? You know, so that means being up with play all of the time, making the right shouts. You know, referees, you don't often get a round of applause for making a good decision, do you? You know what I mean? So
rarely.
Yeah, it's a little bit like eyebrows. If you notice them, there's a problem.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I suppose, Greg, that's one of the things refereeing-wise. You're trying to, playing-wise, you're trying to, you know, read the play. But as a referee, you have to do that more so, because you're always trying to be in the best position possible and to think of where's the ball going next, where's the play going. So you're trying to be maybe four or five steps ahead of maybe the player.
That's it.
To know where she's going to be in that position.
In a job like this, you know, say for instance for the 3 hours, there's an awful lot that I have to keep my attention on, you know, be it technical, but also, you know, if someone says something that could be problematic or you know, you're constantly switched on. And I find it in ways more draining than when I used to do physical labour. You know, I come off air and I can be exhausted at times, and I'm not complaining, don't get me wrong. But, you know, do you find that, you know, with being switched on, you know, the build-up to a game, and they're all important, right? But also having to be alert the entire time. You know, what's it like then when the game's over?
Tiring, I would say. Mm. Yeah, definitely after a game, especially like National League, I did on Sunday, you're not doing anything really Sunday evening. And you're right, like you take that, for example, you're taking an example of maybe a player soloing a ball down the middle of the field. As a referee, you're watching her, first of all, to see is she going to foul the ball. You're watching a defender. You're watching maybe two or three defenders coming in. You're trying to watch, you know, in front of goal, the defenders and the attackers, if there's anyone kind of pulling or dragging or pushing off the ball. So, you know, someone just sees a player two or three solos down the field, you're watching about 10 players yeah. there.
Especially if you're primarily watching it on telly, you really exactly. don't see it all, you know. So you obviously, as a player and as a coach, and manager as well, right? Did and we have a great shortage of refs, and it's kind of getting worse, it seems, but also particularly women, right? So is it something that you really wanted to do, or is it something you felt that you owed the game? Well, not that you owed anything, don't get me wrong, right? But what was the balance there between thinking, you know, I'd like a crack at that, or, you know, really, I love this sport, I need to do another bit here?
Yeah, I suppose like that. I was playing, I was finishing, I still wanted to be involved. I was involved, I suppose, administration level, development level and refereeing. I hadn't seen it from that side. Probably had seen it from every other side, the boardroom and the likes. So that was one. But I suppose it was the visibility for me as well. You know, you do have the likes, obviously, Maggie Farrelly was the first one to break the mould and to go and referee. You have Siobhan Coyle here in the county as well, another national referee. Once you see people like that, then I kind of thought, do you know what, give it a go. Mm. And for me as well, bit of a challenge. It's a challenge.
One thing I noticed over the last couple of years about women in sport, and we're talking about the positives here, and I will focus on them, is that there were almost strangely a pushback that, you know, women would become, not particularly necessarily in this country, though I did see it with some of the punditry and presentation, but people seem to be threatened by it or something, right? So there's a pushback, you know, about women particularly maybe commentating or reffing in the men's game. So I hope we're not going backwards. But do you get a sense of that, or what's your overview? You probably know some of the cases that I'm talking about, and the fact that it's a conversation whether a woman is reffing or a pundit or presenting a show.
Yeah, it's a tricky one that, Greg, because, yeah, as you say, you do have females obviously commentating on that, on particularly the men's game. Mm. And I suppose the issue there, well, it's a great thing. It's those females are actually kept up to date, be it the hurling or the J football. But I don't think you have it on the other side. So if you take ladies football, there's probably more female pundits in that because they keep up to date with the female game.
I get
where
you're coming from.
You probably
from, yeah.
don't have the yeah. males or the extent of. Mm. Like if you see now, you know, and they are visible on TV, it's your inter-county players, female players that would have played but still keep up to date with both the ladies and the men's code. That's not the case. You don't see, you know, ex inter-county male players actually keeping up to date.
Yeah, I get you.
And
so
keeping
it's about
tabs
your knowledge
on the ladies'
base as well.
Game.
Yeah,
so there is that too. Yeah.
Is there any reason in your view why we shouldn't see more female refs or umpires or what have you in both male and female sports?
To me, there shouldn't be. There shouldn't be any barriers yeah. there. It probably, as you say, maybe social media-wise, maybe they're a little bit quicker to criticise the female, I would say, mm. in comparison to the male. That has pros and cons.
But I think that's fading out a little bit as things become the norm, if you know what I mean. Like, whether you watch GEA now or soccer football or darts or whatever, you know, the more women are actually in those positions, I think that the more normal it becomes, and we'll see less of that sort of social media pushback from that minority of...
Yeah, you would hope. And I suppose, Greg, like that, you're saying it is a minority. It is very much a minority because if you take, looking at ladies football, even if you take the club teams in the county here in Donegal, a lot of those are coached by males that have, you know, that are helping out. So it's not all males. There's a small select few. Mm. And Greg, it's males and females.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
as
I
well
never mentioned that,
that call
sure.
out
yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Both, but it's a society issue mm. as well, I'd say.
Why do you think we have a shortage of referees? Both male and female, I suppose. Is it because it's seen sort of as a can't win, you know, situation or
it can be, I suppose. It depends, maybe as a referee, I would say your approach to it.
Yeah.
Maybe as well, you know, if you're committed and dedicated to it, you know, if you're along the mindset of you're going out to referee a game, these players, you've 40 players maybe all in, like they're training 2, 3, 4 nights a week. As a referee, you do have to be on the top of your game.
Yeah.
So you do have to watch your, you know, your hydration, your nutrition, your sleep, your recovery, all of that, you know, has to play a big part in your week to week.
In officiating either on the pitch or somewhere else in the associations, what do you have an ambition or a goal, or what would your dream thing to do be?
I suppose, listen, yeah, long term, on a national panel now, yeah, you're kind of thinking long-term goal is All-Ireland final, Croke Park.
Great,
do you know,
it?
National anthem playing. Absolutely, that's your goal. But I suppose, do you know, short-term, in order to get there, you have to be doing it week in, week out, and you have to be consistent. But in saying that, Greg, like, you know, as a club, maybe players get to play on their club pitch. I still haven't refereed in my own club pitch, St Michael's Undon Fanny. So while Croke Park is one of my ambitions,
let's get into St Michael's.
Do you know,
first,
to actually referee a game down at the bridge in Dunfanaghy would be one of my goals too.
Interesting. That's really, really interesting.
Absolutely,
and hopefully it can be made happen. Why wouldn't it be? Refereeing highlights. Can you enjoy a game? I don't know. I suppose you have to be dispassionate to some extent, right? But there's always going to be experiences you're involved in, like the All-Ireland experience. You'd come off and you go, wow, you'd hope you'd had a great game and go, well, that was a fantastic experience. Have you any of those in the bank yet from your career so far?
I would say, like, that on the field, I don't enjoy a game on the field. You're not thinking...
No, you can't be in that space, can you?
You're there to do a job. You do the job to the best of your ability. That's it. Of course, you come off the field and you're kind of wondering what went well, what didn't, what do we need to work on as a team or whatever. But I suppose highlights-wise, I've been lucky enough, ref underage finals, schools finals. I did a college's final last year. I was lucky enough then to travel abroad to Abu Dhabi for the Middle East finals, US finals 2 years ago.
What was the temperature like?
Quite hot, yeah. So it was.
Right, lads, I'll be up there in a sec. You batter on.
It's about, you're talking about 35, 40
degrees.
And
they're training and playing
used
over
to it.
There, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You haven't had the climate training yet.
And Vancouver, actually, we were over for the Canadian Championships in August, and that was hot in August as well. Like, so, but that's where your training comes in, your hydration and everything as well. You're looking after in the lead up to that.
So sometimes at the, say the lower levels in terms of, you know, junior, intermediate, what have you, you know, but say, for instance, with the ladies game, because the rules are different, so I'll focus on that. You know, you've got your supporters that are there day in, day out. They know everything that's going on, right? But of course, then you've got your bandwagon jumpers. So, you know, the team gets on a little bit of a run and you've got people that don't ordinarily watch the ladies game turn up. Do you ever, because there are some rule differences, is whereby you hear someone screaming from the bleachers that you've got something wrong and you feel like telling them, well, this is a different...
different rules. Yeah. Different rules and a different code, yeah. It does happen. And Greg, I suppose that's the main issue I would have at the minute. If there's one thing I could change is that you have a lot of individuals, you know, that are great. They're coming supporting, they're helping out, but they actually don't know the rules of the Ladies Gaelic, or like that, they think the Ladies Gaelic is the exact same rules as the J. And they're different. So, listen, you do try and combat that as well as regards your communication on the field. And, you know, you try and make that fairly obvious to people as well without calling that out, so that it is, I suppose, a learning experience for everyone.
Yeah, maybe they'll know the next time.
Hopefully.
instead of blaming poor Sinead. And also, too, how are we in terms of our sideline behaviour? Because sometimes we confuse we don't really see the line between passion and maybe not being as supportive of our younger players as we should be, or maybe not considering that someone like yourself, there's better things arguably you could be at, right?
Yeah.
On a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday afternoon and the sideways rain's taking the head off your shoulders. The spectator discipline, is it something we need to look at, or generally are we okay?
It depends. I would notice, Greg, there's a big difference between, like, if I were to take a senior club championship game, or indeed, you know, inter-county game, I would take an inter-county game all day over an under 12 club game. And that's reality. It is at the lower age groups. It's at your 10, 12, 14 age groups, I would say, where there's a lot more vocal along the sideline. There's a lot more shouting, do you know, whereas I suppose I can just let the players play.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know, at that stage? But yeah.
Last question. Who's your favourite team to referee? No, I'm only joking. we're speaking to...
I can't ref Donegal, I'm afraid.
We're speaking to Sinead McHugh, who's a referee. It's part of the Donegal Sports Partnership's involvement in the Women in Sports Week 2025. And there's lots of bits and bobs going on around the county. Check out Donegal Sports Partnership's social medias and website. And also you can book some of these events I'm about to mention on Eventbrite. Tomorrow, by the way, at the Atlantic Technological University, the ATU in Letterkenny, there is a taster sessions, climbing of walls, pickleball and relays. If you're interested in seeing what that's like and you're free tomorrow afternoon, go to Eventbrite via the Donegal Sports Partnership page. On Friday, as part of Women in Sports Week, there's a sunrise dip. It's at Rathmullen Pier at 7 a.m. On Saturday, there's a yoga and a dip at Coldaff Beach at 7:30. There's an open water dip on Saturday as well at Throppany Pool, Bundoran. You can also go and try fishing, actually, which is quite interesting, at Mungari Trout Fishery. This is in association with the Deal Community Anglers. That's at noon. And then on Sunday, a taster of horse riding at Drumdoit Stables. The session's at 11, 12, 13, which is 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. So check out Eventbrite via the Donegal Sports Partnership page. Would you recommend people to get involved in refereeing? Because obviously, you know, the default position when someone like me is going to interview you is to focus on, you know, the social media, the abuse, the this, that and the other, right? But, I mean, there's also a massive sense of being part of your GEA community,
yeah,
contributing to it. The majority of people which are polite and say, great game, Sinead, or you did fantastic there, or that was a tough one. That, you know, the normal discourse, there's a lot of positives there as well. So are there enough positives for you to say, lads or ladies, see if you can join the ranks of the refs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Greg. I suppose one thing that I'd say, naturally, you know, my biggest regret as regards refereeing is that I didn't start sooner.
Right.
Such as, you know, better than playing as well. I know you're part of a team, you know, when you're playing, but the challenges you get, the sense of satisfaction that you get from after refereeing games. And for me, I suppose it's to be a role model as well for females. What better way? And so, you know, in the middle of the field, and you've 30 players around you, do you know, and trying to do a good job. So I would say absolutely anyone actually thinking about it, just jump in, go for it. Do you know, I know you hear a lot of negativity about it, but the opportunities that are there for females in particular to move up quicker is quite good. Like I said, the opportunity to maybe go abroad, referee.
Yeah,
you know,
fantastic stuff.
It's great, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, Sinead, I'm glad everything's going so well for you. Can't wait for you to get reffing on your own pitch. And who's to say Croke Park couldn't be next? Sinead, thanks very much indeed. And it's great people like you, an inspiration to younger people, particularly women, because if you see someone else doing it, you think, well, I can do that too. I can be the next Sinead McHugh. So thank you so very much for calling up. I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And check out the Donegal Sports Partnership for more details on some of those events and activities coming up over the course of this week. Right, we're going to take a break, back very shortly. Very pleased to welcome on to the programme now Professor of Politics at DCU, Donacha O'Bachan. Thank you so much for joining us. I really do appreciate your time.
Not at all, Greg. Pleasure to join you.
Right, okay. So a lot going on. Since I last spoke to you, my word, so much has happened. I suppose the latest development, and they're almost hourly, not daily, is Trump pausing military aid to Ukraine. This followed on from those scenes in the Oval Office at the start of the weekend. What are we seeing unfold, in your view, Donacha?
I think this is part of what is a general disengagement from Europe. This is the big takeaway. It's nothing really down to the theatrics we saw in the Oval Office on Friday. I mean, that was interesting television, as Donald Trump put it. But, you know, this disengagement was happening anyway. And the announcement today that aid to Ukraine is ceasing is a symptom of a policy of disengagement. And in terms of its historical significance, we have been here before. In the 1920s and 30s, the US withdrew from Europe and it wasn't even a member of the League of Nations. Interestingly enough, Elon Musk during the last day has said that the US should not only leave NATO, but it should leave the United Nations as well. So this is part of a general disengagement. And we all know what happened in the 1920s and 30s. Of course, there was a vacuum left in Europe. There was a dictator who was trying to unilaterally redraw the boundaries of Europe by force. Europe is in a much more secure place than it was in the 1920s and 30s. Germany is not fascist. Italy is not fascist. They are democratic and they are the bedrock of the European Union. But I think I would be I would be amiss were I not to emphasise that we haven't been in Europe at a more dangerous point for several decades.
But this has certainly accelerated over the last number of days. Do you not see a potential, because things move so swiftly, of those relationships between the United States and Europe improving, Zelensky coming on board, signing his deal? You know, is this not gesturing by Donald Trump as a means to an end rather than, you know, a new dawn of political relationships globally?
No, I think it's reflective of a new alliance, kind of alignment in global politics. I mean, you only have to look at that vote at the United Nations General Assembly, where Russia aligned itself with, sorry, the US aligned itself with Russia, with Belarus, with North Korea, and with Syria, and with Eritrea, and other dictatorships. And, you know, it's ostensible European allies were on the other side of the table. I mean, this is not really about Ukraine. This is about reaching out to Russia, because they see a much bigger deal is possible, more advantageous to the Americans. So, and they see Europe as an expensive ally. I mean, they think that solidarity is in the past. I mean, Donald Trump keeps emphasizing that Joe Biden was played, that he was essentially taken for a ride. And that's why we have this minerals deal, of course, because the argument of Donald Trump is that he's not getting the minerals in return for money that he's going to provide for Ukraine going forward. He sees this as back payment. It's a rebate for the aid that they should never have given to Ukraine in the first place.
And of course, there's, you know, the big three, isn't there? The United States, Russia and China. China and Russia have been cozying up. Donald Trump says, right, you know what, we're far better off with a good relationship with Russia. Let's not forget, I think they've completely reestablished their diplomatic channels now. So that's going on in the foreground or background, depending on what you're reading and where you're reading it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we often don't pay enough attention because of the language differences of how this has been received in Russia. Russia is extremely happy with the current state of affairs. It sees now the US as in alignment with Russian foreign policy, belatedly, against an adversarial Europe. Europe is kind of the last stand in a way. They see Europe as a destabilizing force, ironically, in Europe, and the US and Russia could potentially be a stabilizing force. But Russia has not changed its overall objectives in Ukraine. And this is not about, as was often put for external assumption, consumption, NATO expansion. It was about the destruction of Ukraine and the Ukrainian people. And you only have to tune into Russian TV nightly to see that. They see Ukrainian identity as some kind of psychosis. It's almost like they need a national lobotomy to bring them back to their natural state, which is as a Russians. And that's why, you know, the Ukrainians are always pointing out that when it comes to peace, nobody wants peace more than Ukrainians, obviously. But, you know, if Russia stops fighting and the US is not putting any pressure on Russia to stop fighting, then there is no war. But if Ukrainians stop fighting, then there is no Ukraine. And that's why... Yeah. Even though it's a really difficult situation they find themselves in with the absence of U.S. support, they're still not arguing. There's no kind of general mobilization of opinion saying that they need to stop fighting Russia because they know what happens when Russia occupies parts of Ukraine.
But then, you know, I mean, obviously people will be critical of Donald Trump or supportive of Donald Trump in talking of peace, but there was no talk of peace before he intervened. And now we have the French or the UK talking about a coalition of the willing with a view to achieving peace. Why that? Why now? You know, because, as I say, there seemed to be no end in this. And now all of a sudden we have people in Europe talking of peace, which, to be honest with you, I like to hear.
Yeah, well, peace means different things to different people, as I'm sure you'll understand. And peace is not merely the absence of war. There are many forms of violent behavior which stop short at actually killing somebody. And from a Ukrainian perspective, as I said, living under a Russian dictatorship, which doesn't, you know, allow for the fact that there is a Ukrainian identity or a Ukrainian state, is not peace. And indeed, when the Europeans talk about peace, they talk always about a just and sustainable peace. So they're trying to, you might say, reach out to Donald Trump's phraseology, which is peace. But what essentially what it's like is like, you know, if somebody's trying to break into your house with a big baseball bat. And somebody saying, well, look, if you just stop resisting and let them into the house and beat up your family, well, then everything will be fine. I mean, your resistance is actually the cause of this conflict. And actually, that's another thing that Donald Trump has moved. He describes it as a conflict between Russia and Ukraine rather than an invasion by one stage. Yeah.
And language is incredibly important, isn't it, in matters like this? Danica, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it. Take care of yourself. As I say, I know you're busy, so it's very much appreciated. And Danica has his view. I'm sure some of you don't agree. But anyway, keep your text, calls and comments coming through. Hundreds. We still have loads to get through tomorrow, and we want more. That's it, though. We'll be back at 9 o'clock. But stay safe and stay tuned.